Hi, Dr. Shanahan. Could you introduce yourself and talk about dark calories and what it's about, maybe in a few words?
Yeah, so my name is Dr. Kate Shanahan, and I'm a family medicine doctor. I've been writing about diet and health for more than 20 years. And I wanted to write this book because I really wanted to make it clear, you know, everybody's talking about diet and that our health really depends on diet, but no one's talking about these oils, which is why I call it dark calories. But also, you know, people do a lot of talking about avoiding junk food and processed food. And again, we've not been very good at defining what that is. So I just wanted to make it clear that really the conversation needs to start with these oils and what they do to us, given how much we're eating and given how profoundly they affect everything in our body and our health.
Wow, that's great. So now I'm just going to introduce myself and talk about my narrating background really just briefly. So my name is Eliza Foss, and I've narrated maybe over 150 books, but who's counting? And I'm an actor, and I like any kind of storytelling. I also write and direct, including directing audiobooks. And I think audiobooks are a very pure form of storytelling. You're in the listener's head, literally. And I love that. It's very intimate. And you want to bring yourself to the work and talk like yourself and have kind of a conversation, even though it's a one-way conversation. I was an actor before I became a narrator, and it's no surprise that I think that helped me be a better narrator.
But I want to know, how do you pick which projects you're interested in, Eliza?
Well, first of all, I love when an author asks me back for their second and third book. That makes me really happy. I love to narrate fiction or history, and I don't generally love doing nutrition or health books because they can be just a bit dry. But your books, starting with the first one that I ever narrated, I think it was Deep Nutrition and then The Fat Burn Fix. Well, they taught me things that I had never heard about, and you really seemed to me to be saying something new. And dark calories took things to another level for me. I have never been good at science, in fact, really bad at it. And you made all the chemistry really clear and really understandable and actually interesting to me. And I love that I actually felt like I understood chemistry reading your book, listening to myself read your book. And I also love the investigative journalism that you did on the cholesterol issue or myth. I think it's really quite dramatic, and I hope we can get into that later.
So one thing I wanted to ask, and maybe you've already answered this, but I still want to ask anyway, like, how much do you feel like engaging with the material helps to keep things flowing as you're speaking through it? Is it more for you about the material, or more like what actor Chris Walken says about the musicality of the language? Or he reads it backwards so that it's more about the sounds coming out of his mouth than the actual meaning for him.
Wow, I didn't even know that. I'm going to look into that. Absolutely. It's really important to engage with the material. It goes a lot faster, and I do a better job if I'm interested in the material. I did a show with Christopher Walken many years ago. I was just out of grad school and very new to the professional world. I was able to watch him every night, either sometimes from the audience or in the wings, and he was really amazing to watch. He was completely immersed in the story, and I think the musicality, although now it sounds like I might be wrong, because this was a Shakespeare's play, Coriolanus. I think it was secondary to him, but only he could tell you. I think that it's no different with audiobooks. You don't want to listen to yourself read. It's very easy to fall in love with the sound of your own voice and stop trying to get the story across. And you don't want people listening to the sound of your voice. You want them to listen to the story, or in your case, the information. You want to take yourself out of it.
Well, I think you do a great job of expressing things with the emotionality that, like, I always listen. I'm like, wow, that is a kind of how I would have said it myself. So I think you do a great job with that. But it's tough to decide, right? Like, do you feel it kind of bubbling up from within about the choices that you make to portray this or that emotion? Like, is it a conscious choice, or how do you decide what it is?
No. It's exactly what you just said. It's like it's bubbling up. It's like I don't make any choices ahead of time. I like to be inspired in the moment. And not every narrator is like that, but that is how I like to do it. I think it's more interesting for me, and it sounds more spontaneous and in the moment for the listener. And then there's one other thing I would say about narrating nonfiction is that I like to imagine that I'm the writer. And then I like to feel that I have something important to say, something new, and not beat the listener over the head with it, because that's not good. So it's really a tricky balance.
So I wanted to ask, what drew you to narrating Dark Calories? And maybe you've already answered this, but...
What drew me to narrating Dark Calories is your other two books, which I absolutely loved. But let's talk about Dark Calories. What made you write about this topic in a way that no one else has ever before? You talked about this a bit in the introduction, but let's go into that a little bit more.
I really wanted to address the conversation that's currently happening. So, you know, when I first started, nobody was talking about these oils. That was 20 years ago. And now, as the world is waking up to the harms of these oils, many people are talking about them, and they're warning other people. But they're not aware of the full story of just how bad these oils are. And that makes it too easy for people who benefit from the status quo, where no one's really paying attention to them, to shut down the concern. And this creates kind of what I call a noise machine, where it seems like everyone has a different opinion about these oils, and so many other things in nutrition are like that. There's so many opposing voices that this noise machine confuses people and just kind of makes them decide, feel like they're kind of on their own anyway. And they generally settle on an idea, something like, well, the truth has got to be somewhere in between. Maybe they're bad, but they're not that bad. But this noise machine causing confusion is a big problem because it causes inaction, right? People might not be that sure. So Dark Calories will give you the full picture that no one else is talking about, so that you can see through this misinformation that's coming from, unfortunately, the healthcare industry itself, and avoid becoming a chronically ill customer of the healthcare industry.
You know, yes, and it is so clear in your book. And also, remind us of all the places where we can find vegetable oils. I mean, I guess they're in your gummy vitamins, in prepared frozen foods, in every restaurant, even fancy food restaurants. What else? Why are they so ubiquitous and toxic? It's a huge question, I know.
Yes, they are in the world, like everywhere. So there's really two categories of places that we can think about when we're thinking about how to protect ourselves from these things. So the first is where you go shopping for foods. And the second is where other people are feeding you. So if we break it down like that and start with the shopping, then really a simple habit of just picking up everything that has a label, turning that package around and reading through those ingredients lists, because you never know where they're going to end up. They end up in very strange places, like dried blueberries. And you wouldn't expect. So, and then if you're over 40, I tell people you might want to bring a magnifying glass, because they don't want us to find these things, right? They don't make it easy. It's tiny, tiny writing. So that's the first step, and maybe the most important, because, you know, health starts in the home, and this is what you're feeding your family. And then the other category of places is where people feed you. And that's so many places now. So that's the restaurants, including fast food restaurants and fancy restaurants, even the fanciest restaurants. We lived in Napa Valley, and one of the best restaurants in the world there, called the French Laundry, they include canola oil in a lot of their dishes.
You write about statins, and my husband takes statins, and his cardiologist recommends he take statins. And, you know, your book talks a lot about how they might not be so good for you. What can I tell him to make him reconsider taking them?
You know, I'm so glad you are asking this question, because this is a dilemma. And really, it is it's probably the biggest reason that I wanted to write this book. Because, you know, I hear it so often from people who read my other books, right? And the truth is now, there are so many people living in the space where someone they love in their life is afraid to go against the wishes of a doctor that they trust. So in spite of what you know cognitively from what you can, you know, hear other people tell you, there's still that human trust that you get when you're in the room with a doctor. And so I didn't really have an easy answer for this until I realized just how many people I've heard from who say that something like this letter I got the other day. So it was from a recently retired military pilot who said he read Deep Nutrition when it first came out many years ago, and he stopped his statin and he changed his diet. And then he was writing me to say just how grateful he was, even now all these years later, because he's able to enjoy his retirement now. But unfortunately, he has so many friends taking statins who can't enjoy their retirement because he called them, he said they're miserable because they've got muscle aches and they're fatigued and they're disabled.
Well, the problem is though that they believe the whole cholesterol myth. So that there's good and bad cholesterol. And so this is sort of a follow-up question. Can you talk about Ansel Keys and the cholesterol myth? And let's start there.
Yeah. And, you know, like, I hope beyond hope that the people who read this book and understand the whole story, and I'm going to answer your question in a second. That's a big part of the whole story. I really hope beyond hope that people who read this book will start to feel that, like, that feeling inside that they need, that they do believe what they're hearing from this perspective, even though it counters their trusted doctors, so that they can gain the confidence and that inner strength that they need to do the right thing for themselves. It really takes a kind of courageousness. So, that's what drives me to write every word on the page, is to just help empower people with that inner trust of themselves. So let's talk about Ansel Keys. He is fascinating, but he is my least favorite person on the planet throughout human history. And, you know, a lot of people ask me, like, how is it that so many other doctors miss this, right? Because there's doctors who are doing research and studying cholesterol. What are they getting wrong? And I have to answer this with a quote from Upton Sinclair. "It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it." And it really kind of explains the situation, you know? Healthcare organizations, they actually know what your cholesterol levels is, believe this or not. And they will pay doctors less if too many of their patients have numbers that are considered high by today's guidelines. And so I want people to understand that this system is rigged. And I spell all that out and give you the names of the programs and everything in the book itself. It wasn't always this way that there weren't other doctors who were trying to get the word out about the truth about cholesterol. In the 1970s, many leaders were standing up to say this is all wrong, because that was the point in time where we had first collected large population studies that were telling us that there's nothing here. The cholesterol theory is a myth. But those folks, you know, that was the 1970s, they're no longer with us anymore. And now there's just so much money in the system from selling drugs that they have the money they need to rig the system. And this is what we learned about in section two of the book.
Yeah. And I just want you to just briefly talk about Ansel Keys and what and how he sort of created this myth.
Yeah. And so he was a passionate believer that diet mattered. And that was a good thing about him. But he got the idea in his head that fat was indulgent and we shouldn't eat too much. And by golly, he was going to make the entire world share that worldview that was his, by hook or by crook. And so he started with that belief, and he had no, like, scientific kind of drive within him to really get to the truth, the deeper truth. It was really just this strong belief that that drove him. And it, you know, there was the good side of it was that he woke up a lot of doctors who weren't paying much attention to food and nutrition. But the bad side and the tragedy of it all is that he was wrong and he couldn't admit when he was wrong and he didn't care. He wasn't interested in the truth.
So, okay, I thought I was a healthy eater. I don't like junk food, except ice cream. I like vegetables and fish and meat. I eat all foods. And I think that maybe that's why it's taken me 3 of your books to really pay attention. And I think what finally made me pay attention to you is your discussion of snacking and pathologic hunger. I realized that this described me. My friends even joke about me needing to eat if I get cranky. They say, oh no, we better get Eliza something to eat fast. And really, they do. So can you tell our listeners your thoughts on snacking and pathologic hunger and what basic changes to their diet people who think they're already eating healthily can make?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, I wanted to have this whole chapter about it because so many people are so obsessed with snacks. And so many people are actually even more concerned about what they can snack on than like what they would have for breakfast. That's often the first question I get when I was working with athletes. It really was driven home to me when I was working with the Lakers because that was like, they all had that question more than anything else. So I wanted to kind of, I coined actually the term pathologic hunger to shake people and wake people up to the reality that normal hunger doesn't make us feel bad. It doesn't make us hangry. It's just a nut, like a little reminder that our stomach is ready for us to send us some food if it's, you know, if there's any available. But the problem is that seed oils build body fat that doesn't give us energy. So between meals, when we try to burn it for energy, we don't get energy. And that gives us this abnormal feeling that I call pathologic hunger, and it includes hangry, it includes anxiety, a lot of other things, because our bodies simply aren't functioning. Our brain isn't functioning.
Okay, so I have one or two questions from friends when I told them I was doing this interview. I hope you don't mind. I promised them I would ask. So the first one is, or maybe it's just one question, I'm not sure, but they all drink oat milk. So many people I know drink oat milk. And do you think that's okay? And if they shouldn't drink oat milk, because I believe oat milk does have vegetable oil, and they can't drink cow's milk, is there a milk you suggest?
Yeah, so oat milk is terrible. Unfortunately, I hate to deliver that news. It's made out of, you know, 2 of the big 3 processed ingredients. It's just refined carbohydrates and the oils and then artificial flavorings. And so there's no nutrition in it. The other thing is it's a huge ripoff. I actually, on my website, I have calculated the ripoff factor for all these fake milks. And that ripoff factor is a ratio of how much it costs the manufacturers to how much it costs you. And so like milk has a, you know, 1-to-1 ratio. That's what I just arbitrarily set that as the standard. And you know, the farmers who make milk, they don't make a lot of money. They're barely getting by. But oat milk, I think, had a ratio of something like 44-to-1, where what it costs you is 44 times what it costs the manufacturers. So it's a ripoff. So what should you do instead? Well, the healthiest vegan milks out there would be almond milk or something based on coconut. But you know what I really suggest is working with somebody who can help you understand why you are intolerant to cow's milk, because sometimes it's lactose. And if you substitute for cream, which has a way less lactose, and you're just putting a little splash in your coffee, you might be fine. So there's a lot to learn about milk itself. And actually, if people want to, they can come to my website and set up an appointment. I can walk you through that. Yeah. So that's it may be that you will be fine with cream.
All right. So, I have just one last question. And, I would say I tell everyone about your books to the point where it might even be a little annoying. So my family tells me, but what do you think could help make this conversation happen on a grander scale than just me and your other fans trying to spread the word?
I think we really need to get doctors to wake up and realize that their good intentions, their good intentions have been hijacked, and that if they start realizing that they have actually been playing a role in the making people sick, and they start realizing that there's so much they can do to bring their patient back to their office with this huge smile on their face because now they feel so much better, they don't even need medications. If we could get doctors to realize that could be their day-to-day experience of working in the office, I think that's really key. So I'm doing that. I'm working, trying to start a new business, actually. So if you're interested in that, you can always follow me on my website. But yes, I really want to get the word out among doctors because I do believe that we have the power to change the system from within. I think consumers are kind of outside the system. And so it's, you know, which is the system I'm talking about? There's two, right? There's the food system, but then there's the healthcare system. And I think that of the two, the healthcare system is the more powerful and the more disturbing at this moment. It's the more disrupted and the more twisted and to use the title again, dark. Right. And so that's where I think the change we're coming from the inside, is really going to make a huge difference. So send your doctor a copy for Valentine's Day, for Doctor's Day, for his birthday, yeah, whenever.
I hope you get to speak at doctor conventions. And can you just say what your website name is just for our listeners?
Yes, drkate.com. So it's drkate.com. And thank you, Eliza, for this great conversation.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.